here with us for the morning show as we spend the hour on the explosion of misinformation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking a deep dive into the nature of how misleading claims spread, the rise of social media and all of this, and how these platforms are now grappling with how to shut down false claims. The Washington Post has a database of false or misleading claims by President Trump since assuming office, and it reported in July that the president had topped the 20,000 mark. What misinformation have you seen on social media or from politicians or the press? How are you able to spot it, decipher it? We're at 800-642-1234. Jevin West is an associate professor at the University of Washington's Information School and the director of the Center for an Informed Public. So he teaches a class about misinformation, and his new book is called Calling BS, The Art of Skepticism in a Data-Driven World. Jevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Well, President Trump spoke last night at a town hall event. He spoke positively about an extremist conspiracy theory, QAnon. He expressed skepticism about mask wearing, and he made false claims about voter fraud. What effect does this have on our society?
Well, I think the effect that it has is we start to lose an allegiance to truth, I think. And I think, you know, some of the most disturbing ones of those three topics was not sort of calling out QAnon. This is a group that arose in 2017, one of those small fringe groups in the internet, built off of some previous conspiracy theories like Pizzagate in 2016. And now it's risen not just in the United States, but across the world. I mean, we've seen over 70 countries with protests, in-person protests with people affiliated to this group. And these are just really a fringe ideas, you know, a cabal of Satanist pedophiles running the world. That's something that you should call out right away.
So, and it's QAnon has been described as a potential domestic terrorism threat. Are there concerns that this misinformation and ideas can actually lead to danger, to terrorism?
Well, that's what some of my colleagues and other researchers and people in the government are looking at right now. And if you track some of these conversations online, they're not all violent, but I would say that there are pockets of them within the QAnon group and other conspiracy theory groups for sure. And so it is concerning, especially because right now there is a level of tension and collective anxiety that we probably haven't seen in a while in this country. And it continues to get fomented. From bad state actors that enter those conversations online, we've seen that, and also just from conversations within these groups. And so it is concerning, and it's concerning because it affects us every day. In the Pacific Northwest, so we're at the other UW, University of Washington.
And we'll accept you nonetheless.
Searches, you always win the Google searches for sure when we say UW. We never win that one. So in the Pacific Northwest at the University of Washington, we experienced some of the worst fires that we've ever seen this year on the West Coast. And there were calls to the 911 centers that were over flooded with concerned citizens about either Antifa or Proud Boys calling or starting these fires. And this was getting in the way of real emergency responders because they were trying to find where the fires were, where they needed to get people out of these different towns. And so I give this example because it's symbolic of what we're seeing more broadly in society, that these rumors online are getting in the way of actually getting things done. And I think it applies to the pandemic. It certainly involves some of the collective decision-making that we need to do during a big election. And so it affects us directly. It affects our health and safety. And we're just seeing it higher densities than we've ever seen.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jevin West, who is director of the Center for Informed Public at the University of Washington, co-author of a new book on the spread of misinformation, What Can Be Done About It. Taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. What misinformation have you seen on social media or from politicians, reporters? How have you been able to recognize it, spot it? And then what do you do with it? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jevin, I want to step back here. How do you define BS? How do you know that it is and call it?
Well, we have a strict definition, and not everyone follows our strict definition, and we quibble over every single word and definitions in academia, probably way too much, more than we should. But we have a specific one. My colleague Carl Bergstrom and I spent a lot of time on this definition. So the way we define it is we of course, think it involves language and rhetoric, but we also think it involves statistical figures and data graphics and other forms of presentation intended to persuade by impressing, and this is the important part of the definition, and overwhelming a reader or listener with blatant disregard for truth and logical coherence. So a liar knows the truth and just is moving you away from the truth, whereas a BSer sort of doesn't care where the truth is. He or she's just trying to grab your attention and overwhelm you with expertise and language and sort of just being an expert, supposedly. So it's something that involves more than just language. And we spend a lot of time talking to students and the public about BS that comes wrapped in data and numbers. And we've seen a lot of that during the pandemic. We could have actually rewritten the book just on the pandemic and the election right now with the misuse of data and graphics. Now, of course, we talk about, quote unquote, fake news and disinformation and misinformation. But we spend a lot of time talking about the misinformation that comes wrapped in numbers.
Mm. Explain the distinction there between misinformation and disinformation. Where does it cross over?
Yeah, the big difference comes down to intention. So misinformation can include misleading content, false content that arises accidentally. And that's, I still think, the bulk of the false information that we see out there. It's kind of like the game of telephone. Someone says something on the internet, starts to morph, and maybe it started with good intentions. Now, disinformation is the type that we're more concerned about sometimes, because that's intentional misinformation. This could be from bad state actors. It could be from professional conspiracy theorists. They do exist out there. They live and they breathe for conspiracies, and they make a lot of money on it. There's also people that are pushing propaganda. So the big difference between misinformation and disinformation is intention. And so it turns out, though, disinformation is really hard to measure, because disinformation campaigns a lot of times have grains of truth in them, and they're usually a collection of articles. So when we do our work, it's not just fact-checking one particular article. It usually is a collection of strategic efforts that are across platforms and across certain narratives that we're seeing. So disinformation is hard to identify, and it's hard to measure intention, too. But that's the difference, is intention.
And you mentioned fact-checking there. What is the role of fact-checking these days? Does it make a difference?
You know, it does. It does seem like a Sisyphean task, where you feel like you're rolling the rock up the hill, it falls down, you roll up, you're just playing whack-a-mole as you fact check all the time. And sometimes it might make a very small difference, but it's important that we do it. Or we might have a rise of another QAnon group, like we just talked about. The rumor mills are going to continue, but we do need to fact check. Now, there's lots of different ways of doing fact checking. We can rely on the professional fact checkers, and they do an enormous service for us on the internet. But this is the PolitiFacts of the world, Snopes, etc. These are professional journalists that spend every day fact checking all the BS on the internet, and sometimes they find that the rumors are true. Not all rumors are false. But then there's the fact checkers that are us. I think one of the most important things that we can do in the United States right now is spend more time with the public and with students of all ages, so from K-1 to K-99, becoming better information consumers, because it's really hard and we just need to create better habits of mind, but it's just something that's still new for us.
Let's pause there with Jemin West, heads up the Center for an Informed Public at the University of Washington. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the spread of misinformation and the campaign to crush it, to promote media literacy. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Health Organization has said an infodemic of misinformation is undermining efforts to combat COVID-19. Cornell University researchers studied 1.1 million articles from media outlets containing some sort of misinformation. They found 38% included a mention of President Trump in the context of the misinformation. Where do you get your information about COVID? How do you know what to believe? Are you alarmed by people falling for conspiracy theories? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jevin West is an associate professor at the University of Washington's Information School, and his new book on misinformation is titled Calling BS. Let's take a call now. Dimitri is joining us from Glendale. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, Professor West. Thank you very much for your nice work. I wanted to make a comment that I am an information skeptic, but I'm also a PhD-wielding information skeptic, and my sense is that the rise of the Internet kind of had an unexpected effect of killing off a lot of local journalists and a lot of other diverse sources of news. And as a result, we end up having just a few sources of news repeating the same information on all channels, and those sources of information tend to be highly agendized. There's an infinite number of stories that can be said any day, an infinite number of ways, yet we keep hearing the five same stories with the same keywords over and over again. In my opinion, I feel like that may be a reason why people have become increasingly skeptical of news, because it seems like any news we get is part of a larger narrative. And I wanted to get your sense, how do you see the role of large media and their agendizing of their news and journalism affecting the rise of the BS information that's percolating through the network?
Dimitri, I think it's a really good question, and you should reach out to me because I think you've clearly been thinking a lot about this. The one thing that you started with, you said there's this problem of an erosion of local news. And I think it's one of the most important things that we need to be paying attention to over the next 5 to 10 years. For people that aren't following us, there are news deserts popping up across the United States at alarming rates. These news deserts are places that just don't have local news anymore at all. They lose their local newspaper. They don't have anything other than this national news narrative that you mentioned. So if I had one magic wand, it would be to reinvigorate and reinvent the business model and to bring back that local journalism. That it's clearly important and people need to do it, and hopefully we'll get behind that. But then you shifted your question over to these larger narratives from large, some of these large cable news networks, et cetera, saying the kinds of same things. And I think this is right. One thing we have to always remember is it's being driven by a business, and they're driven by clicks. And it's different than the subscription-based models that we had in previous time periods. So nowadays, articles compete with themselves, even in the same, journalism venue. And so, they're conservative, too, in some ways, where they want to talk about the same things. And they're purposely pushing narratives together. I mean, a lot of times they'll want to take a story and keep saying the same kinds of things. And the problem is, not only do we get this very kind of skewed version of the world, and a world that foments, that the other person and the other side and the other tribe is bad and vilifies them. It also what it does is it makes us feel as if that there's nothing else being reported. And we see online a lot of people's discontent with quote unquote mainstream media is it's underreporting other subjects that they do care about. And so they do think then there's a conspiracy theory under it. So it's completely a problem, both that local journalism is being degraded and that our national conversation, especially the hyper-partisan conversation that comes from these big media companies, is, I think, adding to the problem to a severe degree. So thanks for the question. It's super important.
Dimitri, yeah, thank you. Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. I think it's fairly simple. I think first, we should stop consuming everything that's being fed to us in the feed. I think second, we need to check stories with credible news organizations outside of the United States, like the BBC, NHK World, or Deutsche Welle. And third, we need to remember that an entire mountain of lies can be built upon a single truth. But if you take that single truth out and set it on top of that mountain, the entire mountain will crumble under the weight of that one single truth. And we need to find those truths.
Marcus, thanks.
I love it.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, Marcus, both Marcus and Dimitri should be on this call too, full time. They're really, really good points. And I do think that's interesting about this news feed. There's a lot of debate right now about social media companies being more transparent about what they're doing, and they have invested a lot of resources into this news feed, and they don't like to give it up because they can then control the advertising flow and the user eyeballs on these platforms that way. But the thing that's always just irritated me as a personal user, as one that studies this social media and also, of course, you know, uses it, I just think it's crazy that we can't control our own newsfeed, too. Maybe I want it chronologically ordered instead of ordered by some black box algorithm. And that black box algorithm right now is just there to, you know, stick our eyeballs to the platform. And it's something that that objective of maximizing that doesn't necessarily bode well for society. So I totally think this newsfeed thing is something we should address. And maybe it's one of those things that we make more transparent. And, you know, all the other things you said, Marcus, are spot on as well. And I think we should be diversifying our news diets, looking at places like BBC and others that are reliable. And they don't get it right all the time. Sometimes they get it wrong because humans are involved. Scientists, and I work in science, they make mistakes too. But as long as those are more reliable, they admit mistakes, they have some humility at getting the truth, that's the kinds of sources that we should be looking for.
We have Jevin West with us, co-author of a new book on misinformation. He's a data scientist at the University of Washington, and he builds models and algorithms to explain how information flows through our society, through our news feeds and social media. You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Jevin, I want to look a little closer at these social media companies, or just the platforms. YouTube says it's going to prohibit videos promoting conspiracy theories that, quote, justify real-world violence. So what do you make of these moves, and is social media doing enough to stop the misinformation?
So first, I don't think they're doing enough. But second, I do think they're at least doing something kind of for the first time. I think the pandemic was the first time that I saw them doing things that were a little bit consistent and that were actually making some difference. So at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of the social media companies came together, you know, I think more informally, but provided some very specific policies on what violated sort of their usage on their platforms. And they were taking things down because they had these specific policies. But they're still playing catch up, even with the election right now. Of course, the news the last couple of days has really circled around the Biden son's emails, whether that the New York Post article was a real thing, and you know, Facebook and Twitter and YouTube all doing different things. So it shows that they're still trying to figure out what's going on. But they are, I will say, they're making steps that are in the right direction, but it's a hard position to be in. I'm highly critical of these social media platforms and have been for a long time, but I will say it's a very hard problem to deal with. They don't want to be editors. It's a really big problem. It's got a scale that, you know, no one would ever want to deal with, but hey, they're making plenty of money doing this kind of thing. So I think there is some responsibility on their side. And for the last thing there, I would say that pay attention to this issue around Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act. Everyone's starting to see maybe 230 in conversations, even from the president. And what's interesting about this particular policy, which gave immunity to these platforms where they couldn't get sued for the content that was put on their platform, that it's Democrats and Republicans are both wanting to revisit it, but for different reasons. Democrats feel like there's too much power and that there does need to be some work in filtering some of the bad content, whereas Republicans feel like the other part of the law, which allows these platforms to remove content, they feel like it's a violation of their First Amendment. And so there's going to be some interesting conversations, no matter who wins the presidency, around this Section 230. And I would have people pay attention because the society should have a say in that conversation.
Let's bring in Dave now in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Good morning. My question is, I heard recently that CNN or other news organizations lobbied the government to redesignate news as entertainment. And of course, that creates a whole Pandora's box. And I'm wondering if you've heard of that and if it's true.
So, Dave, I have to admit, I haven't heard of that. I try to keep on top of all of these things, but it's something we should be doing a little fact-checking. We actually have a network of students and postdocs, and we work with fact-checking organizations to check these. So I will – you gave me some more work to do after this call. Thanks a lot, Dave, in a good way, of course. But, you know, regardless of what we find, it is an interesting issue itself, about news being entertainment more than sort of news itself. And what we're seeing right now in 2020 in journalism more broadly is having to redefine what these platforms are, whether they're media platforms or whether they're just platforms, and news itself. You know, certainly I think news, unfortunately, in many cases is entertainment. And you'll see a lot of tricks to keep us glued to the platform that have nothing to do with the content itself. So for example, you'll see forward referencing headlines everywhere on CNN and Fox and MSNBC and various other news stations. These are headlines that don't give you the answer. Like, these are the five professions that will lead to early heart attack later on, or something. You know, they never tell you the answer.
World of tease.
It's a world of tease. I like that. That's the best way to describe it, Kate. I've heard, like, it's a world of tease. And so it is entertainment. And the sad thing is that a lot of what we're seeing on the platforms are being decided by algorithms.
And we have to pause there with Jevin West. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're learning how to spot nonsense, think critically about news, about sources, data that comes at us. It's an hour-long conversation about misinformation, false claims here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And, you know, it feels like we're at this critical juncture where COVID is raging, the presidential race intensifying. There are half-truths, there are distortions, they're flying all around. And the World Health Organization calls it an infodemic that is only going to intensify. University of Washington opened a center last year to study the ways misinformation spreads and the best methods to combat it. Do you feel like you can tell what's real and what's fake, or do you not believe anything you read anymore? What do you do when friends or family share information that you know is untrue, inaccurate? How do you respond? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Jevin West, who is an associate professor at the University of Washington. His new book is titled Calling BS, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. Katie is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Katie.
Good morning. Thank you for this conversation. I've had a lot of conversations with family members, specifically my mother, who has expressed the idea that because a source has been used by an anchor or by a talking head, that it must be true. And so I keep looking at it from the angle of, we have it, and it's on both sides, left and right, in terms of media. We have things like most trusted anchor or most trusted source or most trusted news anchor or source, whatever you want to call it, agency, whatever they name it and brand it. And I keep thinking about, how does ethos and trustworthiness and reputation play in terms of how much we believe these people are saying?
Yes. So, Katie, I think another great question, and that's something that we're discussing a lot in our center. So we see all the time from our own fact-checking efforts that these talking heads that you're referring to, both from the left and the right, are not as reliable as we would hope, given the influence that they have. Many of them have, you know, millions of followers every single evening that they're speaking. And I can point to literally hundreds of examples over the last year where these talking heads are just entertaining. This is, gets back to our previous person, instead of really doing a reliable research, fact check research, and having people vet this information. And so, you know, reputation should matter, but I think sometimes it's like reputation doesn't matter to them. It's just getting that next viewership, a viewer onto that show. And I feel like if you looked at their history, that their reputation wouldn't be as high as it should as a journalist with that much influence.
So how should Katie go about communicating with her own mother when they have these, you know, differences in how they look at information?
Well, I struggle with it, too. I have family members and friends and neighbors that we have sometimes these tough conversations. And I think some of the things that are more reliable than others and that has been found in research doing some of this work, I mean, first of all, you know, they're not too complicated. I mean, go into these conversations with empathy. A lot of times your mother or your uncle or your neighbor are doing these things because they truly believe them. And I think doing it with some sympathy always helps. Trying to do it in a one-on-one setting rather than calling them out on social media I think is more effective. I think starting with questions too, where did you get this information? How did they know that? Have you looked at some of these other places? Trying to do this, takes time. And I think we need to do more of that instead of just yelling at the Twitter board that's coming in or the Facebook posts that are coming in or the news station on television. So I think it's starting with empathy is probably one of the most important things that we can do.
So your Center for an Informed Public, it doesn't focus on partisan BS, but you are tracking BS circulating about voting. What are you seeing out there on voting?
Well, voting, we would think, is a nonpartisan issue, and we are a nonpartisan center. We take that very serious. Actually, in my class, when I teach this, when I show an example, let's say, from the left media, I show one from the right media and vice versa. What we're seeing with voting are some large narratives that are hovering over most of what we see. So they all kind of feed into these narratives of things like mail ballot harvesting. This is this idea that people are paying and gathering, voter ballots from lots of people. Mail dumping has been something that we've seen a lot of. Delegitimization, we've seen that all the way up to the leader of the free world on that particular issue. And so all these little memes or posts that we see sort of feed into those narratives, sometimes strategically, sometimes organically. But what we're seeing, sadly, is that when making these cases of mail dumping, like a photo of United Postal Service worker dumping mail, some of them are actually true images, but they're from previous time periods or previous election periods, or they're strategically amplified in ways that are not being honest to the framing. There's all
when
sorts
you
of
say
things
strategically
done,
but amplified, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So strategic amplification is when you have multiple individuals on multiple platforms posting at almost the exact same time and then using influencers in the news sometimes. And they amplify those in ways that's not just organic. It doesn't just go viral just because it's something so important to society. It's pushed in strategic ways that takes advantage of the current platforms that we read this news on.
Do you see the manipulation of images still as an issue out there?
Absolutely. We see image manipulation all the time. And today we're living in a world of what are called deepfakes. And so that this is technology that allows me to put anything in your mouth that I want. I can take a video of you, run some algorithms, and they're very cheaply and at very large scales, I can produce videos that make you say anything you want. And so we're seeing a level of manipulation, or at least have the tools for that we've never seen. And so people should look out for deepfakes if they've never heard that. It doesn't mean the world's going to end, but it does mean that you need to be aware of them, because what's even just as more dangerous as the deepfake videos themselves is a politician or leader saying, that's not a real video. That's a deepfake, when in fact it might be. It's something called the liar's dividend. So yes, imagery, audio, and text even is being manipulated in ways that we couldn't do before with technology.
Is it possible for us to tell on face value a deepfake video or a photo by sight? Is it hard to distinguish?
Oh, my goodness. Unfortunately, it's nearly impossible now. It's only getting better. My colleague Carl Bergstrom and I, who's another professor at the University of Washington, last year we released a game that you can go to. It's called whichfaceisreal.com. And you go there and we give you a real image and one that's created with this technology. And it is really hard to tell. And people play the game and are quite disturbed by the fact that they can't tell a real human face from a fake one. And that was old technology. That was a year ago. So it's getting harder and harder. In fact, we just put out another quiz out of our community or out of our center called Spot the Deepfake. You can go there, spotthedeepfake.org. You can go and play the game with these videos, and then you realize how difficult it really is. So nowadays, you just have to rely on some of those old-fashioned methods of fact-checking, corroborations, talking to sources. And if it sounds too bad to be true or too good to be true, it probably is.
We're talking with Jevin West, associate professor at the University of Washington's Information School in Seattle, where he teaches a class called Calling BS. It's the subject of his new book. Taking your questions, your calls, what misinformation have you seen on social media, your feeds, what people are telling you? How do you recognize and spot misinformation? Are you alarmed by people failing to call out conspiracy theories? What actions would you like social media platforms to take to tamp down on disinformation? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jevin, something I'm curious about is the power of retweets, because last night when NBC moderator Savannah Guthrie pressed the president about tweets that spread disinformation, including one post he retweeted that claimed a conspiracy theory about the death of Osama bin Laden, the president said, you know, that was a retweet. That was an opinion of somebody, and that was a retweet. I'll put it out there, and people can decide for themselves. What is the impact of retweeting?
So big. In all of our studies, and we collect billions of public tweets and have been with the pandemic and other events, major events, and it's that sharing without pausing and thinking. We have a saying in the center, think more, share less. It's that sharing that makes this all this information spread so far and have its damage. And so this new policy that Twitter put out a few days ago is a step in that right in the right direction. They now are going to soon, we don't know exactly when, but implement a policy that doesn't allow you just to retweet because of the impact that retweeting has. It's an endorsement. And even if it's not an endorsement by you and you're just saying, well, someone else is saying this, you're spreading it. And if you're a super spreader, like these high influencers on social media, like President Trump, they can have enormous effects, just that retweet. And so we do need to create some policies. And Twitter now says, when they implement this, that you have to comment on it and provide some context. You can't just push that button and then go get your coffee for the morning. These retweets do really matter.
You know, outrageous claims and mudslinging lies, they have been part of campaigns for eons. But do you think there is more BS surrounding our elections than there has been in the past? Can you even measure that?
Yeah, you get to the right point. It's really hard to measure, but sometimes we have to just use our intuition, especially if you study this all the time. And I do think so. I mean, we still need to figure out ways to measure it. But the reason why I could at least argue for why we are seeing more nowadays is that the tools for anyone to push these narratives, to intervene in the election process, are so powerful and so easy to use and so cheap. The investment from bad state actors to get involved and to continue to sort of facilitate foment between the two different parties. And, you can deploy hundreds of bots, thousands of bots. If I had another minute or a couple minutes, I could show, I don't want to show everyone how to deploy bots online. You have algorithms that are pushing this content. You have this ability to spread information so fast. And so I think we really are seeing more misinformation and disinformation than we have in previous periods, partly because it's so easy to spread this.
University of Washington's Jevin West co-teaches a course called Calling BS, where students learn to distinguish truth from false claims and to think critically about what they're seeing out there. Are you worried about conspiracy theories being spread online? How do you guard your social media feeds against election misinformation? Social feeds are most shaped by who you follow. What do you think about that? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jevin West here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Jevin West. He's a data scientist at the University of Washington who studies misinformation in science and in society. He directs its Center for an Informed Public. And in this election season, with a pandemic raging, misinformation seems to be everywhere. We're learning how to spot it and what to do next. So, Jevin, you quote an Italian software developer who notes that it's far easier to create BS than it is to clean it up. So why is that? And is refuting BS ultimately a futile effort?
Well, sometimes it feels like a futile effort, but we need to all be doing it. It ultimately comes down to all of us to be better information consumers. But that quote, I love that quote. It's one of the more important principles in BS studies, if there's such a thing. I think there is now in education. And with the ability to sit in your pajamas and create a fake news story that could get picked up and clicked and you can make money from it, that's easy. What's hard is cleaning up. So one of the examples we talk a lot about is some of the work around pushing out misinformation around vaccinations. There's a famous researcher Andrew Wakefield that published a paper in 1998. They claimed a link between MMR and autism. And that particular paper continues to be cited today, even though it's been fully refuted and retracted by the journal. It is now, you know, created the need to created a lot of doubt in the community. And we see concerns around vaccination rates. And right now in the pandemic, we need people to get accurate information around this. So it's easy to create false information, and it's really hard to clean it up.
You were talking also about how, data, there can be slips. We're human. We can make errors about data. And I understand that there was something circulating in your area about some confusion over 94% of COVID casualties, dying from something else. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, this is one of those interesting cases that illustrates how fast information can travel. So there's a little town next to where I teach on our campus at the University of Washington. It's Woodinville. And there was an individual there who posted on Facebook a comment saying the CDC is hiding the number of deaths out there due to COVID. It's only 6% due to COVID. Now, first of all, CDC has reported this stat, but it doesn't mean that they're under-reporting COVID. It just means that there's only 6% of the cases that only have COVID. The other ones have comorbidities, which just means you may have died of pneumonia, but that pneumonia was caused by COVID. And so this particular tweet was quiet for a few hours, this Facebook post was quiet for a few hours, and then it exploded, and it got picked up by a QAnon influencer, and it even got picked up by the leader of the free world, which was retweeted, like we talked about. And this is an example of something that, first of all, it wasn't true, but it spread around the world from a person just on their couch, posting something that was misleading. So this is the kind of thing that can travel so fast and can have huge influence. Was not true, but a lot of people saw it in their Facebook feed.
Let's bring in Michael now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Michael, hi.
Hi. I love this topic. This is great. My father is one person that loves to spout off stuff that's probably not true. But I was in the comments. I know your guest talked about it a little bit, but I always find that when you're watching TV or when you're watching or something on social media, whenever people are very impassioned about what they're talking about, when they're trying to like yell at you and say this is what's right, it's those are usually the people that are wrong, and it's people that kind of have the cold logic or they're calm, they're collected, they can cite resources. Those are usually ones that you can trust.
I think that's right. And we're emotional creatures, and it's really hard to be that the latter one that's very controlled. But it is that controlled person that's usually more humble about the truth, that points to sources, that points to the complexity of these arguments too. Because when emotion gets involved, it is harder to be rational about it. And also, you can tell sometimes with the yelling person that they're a lot of times finding evidence that confirms their own biases, something that psychologists call confirmation bias. And we all have biases. But when emotion gets involved, it makes it even harder to make a strong case. So when we talk about the refutation of BS, which is a big part of our class and also in our book, we talk a lot about the ways to remain calm and to provide a clear argument. But that's hard to do. It's easier said than done. But I absolutely think that if you had to pick one on average, it's usually the person that's more calm.
Jerry from Campbellsport called in, couldn't stay with us. And Jerry wants to know, Jevin, how much background in the book takes into account changing media sites, like once-a-day reporting compared to 24/7 reporting and errors that can happen during breaking news when news organizations don't have all the information?
It's such an important point. We talk a little bit about it in the book. We spend a chapter talking about changing information technology platforms and sort of the history and how we're seeing those changes today. But this is an important point. This sort of 24-hour breaking news is something that doesn't align with how we should be dealing with information in science and in journalism. We should be taking our time. We should be vetting those sources. But instead, everyone's racing as fast as they can to Twitter or to the news station to report the next piece so that they get credit. And it's being driven again, of course, by advertising dollars. And that leads to a lot of errors. And the problem is, even when those errors are corrected, and sometimes they are, thank goodness, they never catch up with the truth or with the falsehood. The truth almost never catches up. We can actually see that on Twitter. We see falsehoods fly, and the truth, this is a quote from Jonathan Swift from 1710, the truth comes limping after it. The refutations almost never pick up the same number of retweets or follows. So this 24-hour news cycle is a problem, but it gets back to that entertainment issue, that back to a previous question that we've had in this hour.
We're talking with University of Washington data scientist Jevin West. He's our guide, co-author of a new book on misinformation that aims to help us see through all the malarkey raging in the world. Jevin, I want to turn to your class here for a moment. Do you think students today, are they armed with more ability to spot the BS?
Well, the digital natives do certain things better. So they know some of the tricks, and they do know there's a lot of BS out there, almost too much. I almost feel like they're too cynical. We don't want to raise the generation of nihilists that just don't think that anything out there is true. So it's one thing I'm concerned about when we talk about this issue with them. But unfortunately, they're not doing that all that much better. If you look at some of the research, there was a study out of the Stanford History and Education Group that looked at whether students could just tell at least the difference between opinion and fact-based news. Turns out they didn't do so well on that. And, some students do better than others, of course. But even on those basic skills, we need to do a better job in education and teaching students on how to deal with this information world they're dealing with.
So if we would change one thing today and to become better consumers of information, what would you suggest?
Well, first of all, if I had that magic wand, I would reinvent local journalism, like this show right here. Kate, this is the kinds of things that we should be doing more of, investing in more of. That would be sort of a systemic thing that I would do. Individually, what we can do is pause. Think more, share less. Instead of just sharing something, commit yourself to reading the article or doing a little bit of vetting before you share. Now, we can't do that for every article, but if we pause just a little bit more and do a little bit more vetting, if everyone does that, it all adds up and it cleans up the information pollution that we're all dealing with right now.
And as you work in this world of algorithms every day, is the technology on these social media platforms becoming more sophisticated, do you say, or is it changing quite a bit?
Oh, my goodness. These algorithms know more about human psychology than the best human psychologists. They're running A-B experiments literally every second. They're running billions probably every second, peering into what words and phrases and colors and designs pull our eyeballs to the platform. And again, if that's the objective of these algorithms, and it is, that's not necessarily good for society. And they are getting better, though, because they can run all these experiments. And so we do need to pull these tech platforms to the table and talk about this. And so, yes, they are getting more sophisticated to a level that I think quite damaging to society.
Jevin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kate, for the great conversation. And thanks for the great questions that everyone sent in.
Oh, indeed. Jevin West, an associate professor at the University of Washington's Information School, director of the Center for an Informed Public, co-author of the new book called Calling BS, The Art of Skepticism in a Data-Driven World. Just ahead, it's 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.